Hello, and welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. The first LQ update I have is that the LQ Wiki is now an OpenID consumer. And as I had promised in an earlier podcast, the LQ Wiki now allows you to log in using an OpenID. If you had previously been participating at the LQ Wiki, you can also convert that to using OpenID, or you can simply log in with an OpenID as a completely new user and start editing right away. Well, first, I'd like to thank Evan, whose extension made adding this relatively painless. This really is part of a bigger OpenID evaluation that we're doing here at LQ, and we are considering adding both consumer and producer OpenID to the main LQ site, and that is you could either log in and or we would be your actual OpenID provider. So if you have any feedback on that, there's a thread currently going in the suggestions forum, and we'd definitely like to know what you think about OpenID at LQ and really about OpenID in general. Also at the LQ Wiki recently was a pretty significant code upgrade. So if you haven't been to wiki.linuxquestions.org in a while, or even ever, head over there now and check it out. You can help us build the largest general Linux knowledge base on the web. The next LQ update I have is that LQ ISO has now hit 3 million downloads. And I'm definitely happy to announce that LQ ISO has facilitated those 3 million downloads. It's a pretty big milestone. The site continues to grow very rapidly. We now have 418 distributions at the time I recorded this podcast, and they were available from well over 710 different mirrors. We hope that LQ ISO is your first stop when looking to download Linux ISOs. And as always, if you have any feedback or suggestions on how the site can be improved or how we can do things, do let us know. LQ ISO can be found at iso.linuxquestions.org, and it's a way to find fast and free local mirrors for Linux downloads. Now, on to the news. The first story I have is who writes the Linux kernel. And this was from an informative post made over at LWN about the code contributed to specifically the 2.6.20 kernel, and then they followed up with some stats about the last year of kernel development in general. So the results, as far as companies go, Red Hat is by far in the lead, and we're talking now in terms of both number of change sets and also number of lines go. And other top names are really what you would expect here. There was Novell, there was IBM, the Linux Foundation now, Intel and Oracle, etc. I think it's good to see that Red Hat can now really back up the claims that they made that they're doing a significant amount of work in the kernel space. I thought it was interesting to note that Unknown is in first in both categories and None was in third. And the definitions are as follows. Unknown is patches for which existence of supporting employer could not be determined, while None instead indicated the patch was from a developer known to be working on their own time and not associated with a company. I think that really does give credence to the often mentioned statement that some real and significant percentage of the kernel work is done by volunteers, and this does seem to back that up. The article also went into individual contributors a little bit, so if kernel hacking is something you're interested in, you'll definitely want to head over to LWN and read the full article. The next story I have is the free desktop. Bryce Harrington has posted an insightful commentary on his blog about running free software communities. Here are a couple highlights. Quote, "It's easy to just copy what the proprietary guys do. After all, we like to think they're doing scientific market research and usability studies to uncover user needs. Or, at the very least, users grow accustomed to the way that proprietary apps work. So if you make a good clone, you can get into the, well, at least you won't have to bother learning another new niche." That's actually a pretty good niche to be in, but at best, it's nibbling from below strategy. However, in my view, Floss has a secret power for achieving exactly what users need built right into the model. I'd credit a large share of Inkscape's success to simply being utter whores at taking advantage of this. Basically, the best way to get what users want and need into your applications is for the developers to be users. Users have a gut feel for what they want and need, and gut feels are tough to express in requirement documents, bug trackers, and surveys. You know, when you're developing some thingy for your own personal use, what corners can be skipped and what ones are worth polishing. You know what compromises can be made, and can immediately notice the value of some unexpected potential as the code is developed. The reason open source has this special power is because of its openness, transparency, and usually ease of getting involved. Proprietary companies, by their very nature, are characterized as secretive and controlling, and do not consider individual users as able to contribute anything of value to their product but money. Floss projects have a different value model than proprietary ones. Value in Floss comes not from users spending money, but on users and developers who are contributing enhancements such as code, docs, translations, word spreading, and more. End quote. And a second snippet, quote, so to the point, how can the free desktop succeed? Just cloning OS X or Windows isn't going to be compelling enough. Competing on a feature matrix against proprietary companies is hard, since they can pull some new features out of hiding at any point. No, the key to success with Floss is its core attribute, its openness to community-scale collaboration. Focus on energizing a strong community and empowering new users to bring their new ideas and energy in. Give them lots of room to experiment, and assist them with paving a good foundation for them to build atop. Give them invitations rather than rules, and infrastructure rather than bureaucracy. Make it easy for people with little technical skill to participate, and treat them as first-class citizens when they do. Don't think of the free desktop simply as an alternative to proprietary desktops. Instead, think of it as a platform for large-scale open collaboration. For us technical users sharing code, it's already hands down the best collaboration platform. The next step is to work to make it just as good for non-technical users who are driven to collaborate on everything from clip art, encyclopedia articles, music, schedules, designs, fonts, education, games, politics, and so on. Take the rules, tools, architectures, and lessons we've gained in software collaboration and recast them for data development, and I think that free software success will be impossible to stop. End quote. He's absolutely right on multiple points here. It's absolutely critical that you make it as easy as possible for people to get involved, and that's something we definitely try to do here at LQ. And part of that comes from making it clear that you don't need to be a ninja coder to be helpful to a project. You could be an evangelist, you could write some documentation, contribute to the project's wiki, or even submit good bug reports. A user that can post high-quality bug reports that include all the needed information and clear instructions on how to reproduce that bug are worth their weight in gold, even if they are technically unable to provide a patch. Getting community involvement is something you'll see almost all of the so-called winners that we mentioned in last week's podcast do. As Bryce mentions in the article, it's sometimes easy for large projects to become a bit insular. That can be, and really in fact has been demonstrably in the past, extremely poisonous to a project and needs to be something that project leaders are cognizant of. Next, his point about cloning proprietary software is also extremely apropos. Sure, in some cases it's necessary and I'd say even desirable, but it should not be the default action. Working to our strengths, and make no mistake about it, we do have many, will get us much further in the end. If you're considering starting a new software project or are currently running a software project and are being in charge of community, you should read his article, digest it, and then read it again. Community is that important. The next story I have is hopefully my last Novell Microsoft agreement coverage, or nobody reads this stuff. And I wasn't going to mention anything more about the Novell Microsoft agreement on the podcast. To be honest, I really don't have anything else to add, and what really can be added at this point? What more do people have to say? But Don Marty had posted on this issue after Novell contacted him recently as a result of him comparing the deal to Microsoft making them eat a bug for money. And a couple of items in that post were just too good not to share. So here they are. Quote, from Novell's point of view, the deal is supposed to be about giving customers peace of mind over being sued for patent infringement. But the document that is supposed to explain this to customers is missing some information, and the documents that are actually supposed to contain the missing information are secret. I don't think this is some big conspiracy. Just the result of rushing something through without reading it very carefully. Novell and Microsoft are too big to pull off a conspiracy, but they're both bureaucratic enough to do paperwork that ends up being full enough of dumb mistakes to be pretty much meaningless. Simple things first. If you still believe people read this stuff, try reading it. Covenant to Customers has two obvious mistakes. Novell, spelled novel, and the awkward, on account of such customers' use specific copies, which looks like the end result of something starting a singular to plural edit and not finishing. The page has been up since November 2nd of last year. Not a big deal, but like I said, nobody reads this stuff. Now go back and read Covenant to Customers again. You get a bunch of capitalized words, some of which show up in the definition section, some of which don't. One of the terms is clone product. You don't get sued for running a covered product, but covered products don't include clone products, and clone products aren't defined. So which of the products included in SUSE distribution are clone products? I asked, but the list is not available. End quote. It's really not too encouraging when the company name itself is spelled wrong in the document. I can appreciate that novel is a word, so it will have passed through the spell checker, but it would certainly seem to validate that nobody reads this stuff. Don then goes into specifically what the patent portion of the agreement protects you from. Quote, you have a covenant, so you're all squared away, right? But the covenant says it covers covered products, and covered products doesn't include clone products, and you don't get a copy of the definition of clone products, covered or not. You're just as mystified about the answer to, will Microsoft sue me, as you were before. Another good one, Microsoft reserves the right to update, including discontinue, the foregoing covenant pursuant to the terms of the patent cooperation agreement. Yes, the patent cooperation agreement that you don't get to see. Put it all together and you get, we promise not to sue you for running some, but not necessarily all of, the software you get from Novell, unless we stop promising not to sue you, and we won't tell you which software you get from Novell we might sue you for now, or under what circumstances we'll stop promising not to sue you for the rest. End quote. So, in other words, this doesn't give you much or realistically any more protection than you already have. His conclusion is right in line with what myself and almost all others have been saying. And here is his conclusion. Quote, that sense of wanting to win by product, not by litigation, is what protects you in the short term. What protects you in the long term is that the IT industry is just a series of recruiting contests. A company wins recruiting contests by serving good fajitas and letting an employee get a $70 laptop power supply without spending $200 in time on getting approval to buy it. A company loses recruiting contests when it's seen as succeeding through legal attack, not great product. Who wants to work on a product that customers have to be sued to buy? If a company's litigiousness makes it miss a round of recruiting, it misses the round of products that those recruits would have built, and game over. Anyway, the check is cashed, the bug is eaten. Microsoft seems equally likely to sue you for running Linux no matter where you get it. Not very. And if all goes well, a lot of the money will go to the many helpful, hardworking developers at Novell who are doing useful work. I guess what I learned here is that the patent deal doesn't really give Novell customers any special assurances. End quote. To me, Microsoft almost certainly wasn't going to sue you before. This agreement, it would seem, makes them no less likely to sue you now. In reality, it probably did give Ballmer more fodder, which will have some impact. If you do see Microsoft start to sue, to me, that really means that they think they are worse off internally than we think they are from an outside perspective, and that's really not saying a whole lot. Companies with viable business plans and sustainable products don't depend on litigation for future growth. Just ask Go. Now we're getting near that 15-minute mark again, as we did in the last podcast. I'm just going to go ahead and include a couple more stories here to try and catch up a little bit. The next story I have is open source now completely meaningless. So it looks like Nat is building the OSCON schedule for O'Reilly and asks, is open source now completely meaningless? From his post, quote, I found some very strange companies claiming to be open source. Can you really call yourself open source if you haven't opened the source? I don't think so. There's a flood of quote-unquote open source companies selling things that work on open source but which aren't open source themselves. I think these are proprietary products, not open source. That's been the attitude that helped me select talks for OSCON. I only want open source products talked about. My rule of thumb is that the audience should be able to download, compile, and use the software that is talked about. End quote. But he then goes into what are definitely some edge boundary cases, of which Enterprise DB is a good example. I agree with his conclusion that in the end, Enterprise DB and companies like them are good for open source and in the end should be included at an event like OSCON. And really, in the end, whatever O'Reilly thinks should be included is what will be included. A lot of it to me comes down to intent. You see, Being open source, or so-called open source, is the in thing right now. That means some companies are using open source as a dumping ground. Donating old code is fine if there's some real value and a chance that a legitimate project might thrive around the code. Donating code because your company thinks it's completely useless and you just want to get into this whole open source thing, that's really not okay. And despite what some companies may think, it's easy to tell the difference. At this point, we even have some companies simply lying or using the words open source somewhat arbitrarily. To be sure, open source means slightly different things to different people. But twisting the definition way out of whack to suit you is not something you should do. You end up with a situation like Chris DeBona recently posted about on his blog. Intent, in the end, is something that is hard to ascertain in some situations, but I can't think of a better yardstick. You'll always have the idealists who think something is or isn't acceptable versus the pragmatists. Free software versus open source isn't going away anytime soon. We're all in the same larger camp, though, and intent is probably one of the few things I can see most of us agreeing on. And this leads me into the last story I'm going to cover, which is EnterpriseDB an open source company? This was sparked by that post by Nat about his OSCON selection, and there really is now a healthy debate going on about whether companies like EnterpriseDB are or are not open source. Allison, who's part of the O'Reilly Radar team, and the O'Reilly Radar blog is where Nat had originally posted that, is one of the people who says that companies like EnterpriseDB are open source. Matt Acey responded and said that he doesn't think companies like that are open source, and people have kind of been taking sides from there. If this is a topic you're interested in, CBR, as usual, has some very good coverage that I'd recommend you go read. So I've thought about this topic a little bit today and have come up somewhat in the middle ground of the two opinions and think that a new segment of company may need to be defined here. First, let me say, I'd agree with Matt that companies like this are not true 100% open source companies. Allison comes up with a good point, though, when she says the following. Quote, "It seems a bit hypocritical to extol the greater freedoms offered by the BSD license, as its supporters do, and then look askance at companies who use the rights granted to them." End quote. And for those of you unfamiliar with EnterpriseDB, it's basically a proprietary extension on the BSD-licensed PostgreSQL that allows you Oracle compatibility and then some performance and reliability enhancements. To me, it's clear that companies like EnterpriseDB are not what I would call true proprietary companies, that's for sure. They're not even close. It's not just that they base their products on open source or use open source that make me feel this way, though. And let me also add, one of Nat's examples originally was companies that run on open source. If your product simply runs on Linux or any other open source operating system, that definitely doesn't qualify you, in my opinion. The thing here is, in EnterpriseDB's case, they donate to the greater open source project that they're part of in a significant way. They employ some people full-time to work solely on the open source code, and to me that's a big one. They donate money, they donate resources, and just as importantly, they're a big part of that greater community. While not all of their code is open source, they absolutely live and die by their ties and reliance on a specific open source project. And that's unlike some companies who are simply willing to extort open source or open source projects for their gain. Those companies are obviously, to me, in no way open source, whether or not they use or support open source code. Once again, it all comes back to intent here, for me at least. So what do we call companies like this? I'm still thinking about it, but I do think that companies that truly benefit the ecosystem that they're a part of and really do foster the open source project or projects that they work with do deserve an absolutely huge amount of credit. The distinction between something like true open source company and open source company is obviously not clear enough, so we need a name here, at least in my opinion. I don't have one, and if you have any ideas, I'd be interested to hear about it, though. But whatever you call companies like this, I do think that they deserve a shot at being at OSCON. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening.